tuned to the Turley Frequency, starring your host, Kevin Turley, with guest stars Mike Romano and Reed Hodges, and special guest stars, the members of the FCC, whom we respect respectfully. Now, time to get tuned into The Frequency. Call the show at 888-928-0881. That's 888-928-0881. Or text us at 251-928-2111. And now we cross live to the Archangel Radio Studios in downtown Fairhope to at last feel the Turley Frequency.
Yes, hello and good morning to this Tuesday edition of the Turley Frequency. My name is Kevin Turley and I'm your host for the next 2 hours. Today on the show we explore the intersection of a nation's freedoms and its ability to defend its people. We find out the current state of this in today's United States, and to help us with that we talk to retired Lieutenant General Thomas Spohr from the Heritage Foundation. Lieutenant General Thomas Spohr is coming up in the next segment. Top of the hour, we pray the Divine Mercy Chaplet, and you are invited to join us. Feel free to text me your prayer requests. No prayer too small, no prayer too large. 251-928-2111. The lines are open right now. In the final segment today, we hear the moving and still recent story of Chiara Corbello Petrilla, who is now being considered for canonization. She was a wife, a mother, and a faithful witness to life. Stick around to the last segment to find out more. Okay, with all this good stuff, let's get this show on the road. Welcome, welcome, welcome. I hope your Tuesday morning is going very well, wherever you are, whatever you're doing, however you're listening, whether it's on FM, AM, the streaming app, wherever you are, whatever you're doing, I hope it's going well. Now, just today, I came across two stories which were all related to the world of work, and it follows hot on the heels from yesterday, which was the feast day of St. Jose Maria Escriva. Many of you will have heard of St. Jose Maria. He is, of course, the founder of Opus Dei, and one of its chief teaching is around the sanctification of work. So these two stories about work that just popped up into my intray couldn't have been more timely. We'll talk a little bit more about St. Jose Maria in a moment. But in the interim, let's turn to Harrison Ford. Yes, all of you will know who he is. He is, of course, the star of so many Hollywood films, it would take too long to recite them all. He's probably most famous for Star Wars and the old trilogy, the original trilogy from the 1970s, and Indiana Jones. And it'd be fair to say that Harrison Ford is a Hollywood superstar. I mean, he's one of the greatest of that era, of that generation. I say of that generation because I was a bit shocked to discover that Harrison Ford is now 80 years old. 80 years old. But he had this to say about acting and about work. He said that he had no plans to retire, even though he had turned 80. And he said, "And I don't do well when I don't have work. I don't do well when I don't have work." And there's a lot of wisdom in that. There's a lot of wisdom in that. You know, sometimes, and I've worked with people that their whole lives were aimed at one thing, retirement. And that's what they wanted to do. And even young people were looking forward to their retirement when they could do all the things that they wanted to do. I'm sure you've met these people. Maybe you've worked with those people. Maybe you've been guilty of thinking that way yourself. On occasion, I have in the past. But Harrison Ford hits the nail straight on the head. When you love what you're doing, when you feel that that's what your life's calling is, you never really retire from it. And it's true. I mean, in the public sphere, we see it with actors. We see it with musicians. I mean, how many octogenarians are there at the moment that are touring the world on their final world tour? I'm thinking of the Rolling Stones, the Elton Johns, the Paul McCartneys. They're never done playing Vegas or London or wherever it happens to be on their final tour. But you and I know that it is not their final tour. There is no such thing as a final tour. The final tour is the tour to the cemetery gates. For all of us, that's the final tour, but more so for people who absolutely love what they do. But also, what Harrison Ford is talking about to some extent is what work means to us. I don't do well when I don't have work. He's not just talking about having work so he can pay the bills, right? I mean, I think we can all agree that Harrison Ford is a man of considerable wealth, put it that way. I wouldn't like to put a figure on it, but it's probably many, many tens of millions of dollars that he has earned over the years and retained most of it, I think. So it's not about money. It's not about paying the bills. It's not about having to work for necessity. He's having to work for something else, which is a different type of necessity, which is to exercise his gift, to find out who he is, to realize, in a sense, who he is. That's my take on it anyway. And of course, acting gets very well paid. They get lots of plaudits and they probably love all the fuss and attention that comes with acting. And having once worked on a film and been on a film set for many, many weeks, I can tell you that actors are totally pampered. Certainly the stars anyway, totally pampered throughout the shoot. Their every need is catered for in whatever department. You know, if they want this type of food, they want the cars that are there to provide them, to take them from A to B. They live a life of royalty for those 12 weeks, which is why so many actors love to be working on films or on the job, be it television, film, whatever stage, because they are so pampered. But also they are doing what they're called to do. They're doing what they're supposed to do. So that was Harrison Ford's comments yesterday, and I thought they were so apt given the feast day that we were celebrating. But there was another story that came alongside it, which really made me laugh. And it made me laugh for reasons which will become ever more clearer as we go on. And it's somebody at the opposite end of this scale, somebody who's very much younger, a young woman in her 20s. I'm not going to give out her name because it's not particularly relevant. This young woman spends a lot of time on TikTok, I believe. And I've never been on TikTok, but I'm told it's something which people can become quite famous on. You know, they have lots of followers and people subscribe to their channels. And I believe they're very short videos. And so on and so forth. Most of you listening or any of you listening will probably know more about it than I do. But anyway, she's on TikTok, which probably gives us a warning of what's coming next. Because she had a job working, I think it was in some sort of fast food outlet or restaurant or some such. And she turned up for work and her new boss told her that her shorts were far too short. Now, mercifully, we were spared some photographic evidence of this. I don't need to see this in some young woman in her early 20s. But the shorts were too short. Now, they must have been very short in today's climate for anybody to pass comment. And I have to respect the manager of this outlet who had taken the time to speak to the employee and said, look, you know, you're not really dressed for work. Could you go home, get changed and come back? Perfectly legitimate, perfectly reasonable suggestion, I would have thought. You know, I've done that myself. I've done that myself in a capacity where I worked once. I had to send somebody home to get changed, and it was a young woman, and it was all a bit embarrassing. But to be fair to her and to give her credit, she was more embarrassed than I was. She went home, got changed, came back suitably attired. So this young woman took umbrage at her manager's request. And so much so that she decided to resign there and then, but not without filming everything and putting it all on TikTok. She also, this was the thing that made me laugh, she'd been at the shift for 20 minutes. And she was kind of aggrieved that somehow this 20 minutes of her shift was not being catered for, that somehow she was not being repaid for those 20 minutes. I don't know the full ins and outs of it. It's of no great significance, but I think it's a kind of a cultural shift, a cultural clash, which is perhaps more common than we think. And it's about how to work, how to behave in a workplace, which is not as is more mysterious to some than to others. Now, when I was her age, the first thing I would have done would have gone into work probably overdressed, right? And I'm sure that's true. I've been in offices over the last 30 or 40 years, and I've seen people on their first day to work often coming overdressed because they want to make a good impression, right? They want to try to put their best foot forward, as we say. And then as the days go on, they get an idea of what the dress code is and they stick to it. Today, somebody turns up saying, I'm dressing how I like. Their manager says something to them and then they're off. But everything is filmed on TikTok. And the poor old manager then is lambasted by the followers of this TikToker. How unfair she was, how mean-spirited when the poor woman was only doing her job. And the TikToker who resigned also got her own back by saying that the manager was new and nobody liked her and everybody was leaving. You know, the sort of revenge that people have. Now, I'm just going to play a short clip of a video, which you may have heard before, and apologies if you have. But sometimes in humor, there's a lot of truth. And this is a hyper-real situation, which is not a million miles away from the type of situation that we're discussing in today's newspaper. So let's have a listen to a job interview between somebody who's very young and somebody like me who's a lot older and is sitting there trying to work out, is this the right person for the job?
Amy, it says you are trained in technology. That's very good. Are you adept at Excel?
No.
PowerPoint?
No.
Publisher?
Not really.
Exactly in what area of technology are you proficient?
Snapchat, Pinterest, Instagram, Vine, Twitter. You know the big ones.
I'm surprised you didn't say Facebook.
Old people, like my parents. That's funny.
Well, Amy, when you're working for me, you have to have those kind of research skills because I'll send you things for you to comb through and get the answers and send them to me. So for that, you've got to be really good at technology.
For stuff perfectly like reasonable. That, no problem. I'll just ask Siri.
You'll just ask Siri?
You know, Siri tell me this, Siri find me that. We're all good getting you the answers.
Tell Siri I want you ready to go at 8 sharp each and every morning.
I don't understand.
What don't you understand?
What you just said.
You don't understand be ready to go?
No. You said 8, right?
Yes.
8 like in the morning, 8?
Yes, in the morning.
Yeah. That kind of doesn't work for me. Who gets up at 8?
I do.
I Skype with my French boyfriend in Paris until like 3 in the morning. I don't even get to Starbucks until like 10, where I order my grande chai tea latte, 3 pumps, skim milk, light water, 2% foam, extra hot, but not too hot. So if it's okay, I work best in the morning at 10:45.
Wow. Amy, I don't think we're going to be a good fit.
Why are you so negative? I can sense your hostilities, and right now I am not feeling very safe. I've been here for over 5 minutes, and the only nice thing you have said to me was nice resume, which I typed all night for this meeting with you. You've given me no guidance, no validation, no encouragement, no supervision. Is there an HR director somewhere?
HR director?
Yes, I need to speak to someone. I may have to take off today as a mental health day.
Take today off. Amy, look at me. You don't work here.
Right. Thank you, Reid. This is that is a very, very humorous. You may have seen it. It's been on YouTube, that clip, watched by millions of people. It's very, very humorous, but there's an element of truth in it. And certainly the people who were recently booted out of Twitter by Elon Musk, some of them seem to fit that stereotype very much. Of course, if you think this is unfair and millennials have a totally different mindset, we have many millennials who are totally dedicated to their job and doing very well for themselves. You can call in and tell us on 888-928-0888. 781. Tell me I'm wrong. I'm not really interested in the sort of millennial or the other scale, the Harrison Fords, who are still clinging to their jobs, because you could construct an argument that the Harrison Fords of this world need to get off the stage. The Harrison Fords of this world, the baby boomer generation, have been on the stage for about 5 decades, and they don't show any signs yet of getting off the stage and letting people like the young woman in that video getting on to whatever God is calling them to do. So maybe there's a little bit of give and take that's needed here. But as I say, yesterday was the feast day of St. Jose Maria, who is the patron saint, or certainly one of the patron saints, of work. And that's because his teaching was quite revolutionary. And remember, it comes at a time when work and labor were often seen as in conflict, you know, with capital, and that the church was somehow mediating between the two. But what St. Jose Maria was basically saying is that we are not working for the man. We're not even working for money. We're not even working to provide for our families. We are working for God. And that's a revolutionary thought, that our work is something which makes us better people. But it's also something that maybe God has called us to. Now, I came across another video just the other day with Jordan Peterson, who will be known to many of you. He's a Canadian academic and thought leader in many respects, very, very popular on social media, uses it very, very well. And he had this to say about the purpose of work, and he gets it almost right, almost completely right. Now, Jordan Peterson is not a Catholic. I don't even think he's a Christian just yet, but he's sort of on his way. Obviously, St. Jose Maria is a saint and very much a holy man, so he has great insight. But it's really interesting that this is the sort of thing that Jordan Peterson is saying to his audience, and how close it is to the teaching of yesterday's saint. Let's hear what Jordan Peterson had to say in this short clip.
Because even in a simple job, so-called simple job, like, let's say, dishwashing in a restaurant, which I did an awful lot of, it's not that simple. You're dealing with a lot of other people, very fast staff changeover. You're feeding people, you're helping them have a celebration, you're helping them take a break. Like, you can do it really well. And then the kitchen can operate properly, and then people can come out to the restaurant, and it's not a bloody catastrophe. And like, you're, even when you're doing something that's a menial job, so to speak, like dishwashing, there are ways of doing it really badly, resentfully and horribly, and doing it really well. And as soon as you do it really well, it's not a menial job anymore. It immediately transforms. Now, I mean, you can be around people who won't let that happen, and you should go get another job if that's the case. But if you do it properly, then it's not menial at all. And that's also a good way out of resentment. You think, well, I've just got this, you know, two-bit job. It's like, yeah, what if you did it as well as you possibly could? You know, what would happen? Well, the first thing that would happen is you'd get a lot smarter. That's for sure. And that's hardly a negative thing.
That's it. Jordan Peterson is on his way, my friends. He's on his way. He's almost there. He's within touching distance of our understanding of work, which is, yes, all of what he said, that, you know, by doing it, you can learn a lot of human skills. You can get a lot of human virtue from just doing a job well. You get a lot of affirmation from those around you. You're helping those around you. There's lots of positives from doing any job well, even in the case that he gives of washing dishes, which I've certainly done in my time. Oh, we have a call. Let's find out who's on the line and what they're up to in terms of work. Reed, just put them straight through because we're a little bit short on time. Let's find out who's on the line. Caller, you're through to the Turley Frequency.
Hi, Kevin. How are you?
Oh, it's my friend Kirsten out in California. Kirsten, how are you doing?
Oh, my God, I'm doing so great. Thank you so much. Oh, my gosh. Like, you guys, like, must have been, like, praying for me or something because I've been, like, so many movie roles. Like, you were talking earlier about the Harrison Ford. I got a role in the, an extra role in the Dial of Destiny, and it's so awesome. I didn't make the cutting room floor, but, like, I did have a role. Like, I did say a line, like, watch out, Indiana. There's like a big boulder and stuff behind you.
Well, it's a start, Kirsten. Congratulations. That's a start. I mean, having a line is better than having no lines. I mean, that's great. And you've moved on a bit from werewolves by the sounds of things.
Oh, my God. It was so crazy. Like, they wanted me to be like a werewoman. And I was like, I don't think so. Like, basically, it was like, you don't even want to know, like, what they had me wanted me to wear. And I was like, I can't do this. I'm not better than that, you know? Like,
yeah.
It's
yeah.
disgraceful, like, what they wanted me to wear and what they wanted me to say. Like, I'm not doing this. I'm sorry. So yeah. I walked away, Kevin.
Yeah. Well, you were right too, Kirsten. You were right too. And you walked away to something bigger and better. But tell me this. What do you think? I mean, when it comes to acting, I mean, do you have the same view as Harrison Ford, that you're just not yourself if you're not in a role?
Oh, my God. He's so right. Like, I feel like I'm like somebody else. I just enjoy, like, just stepping away and not being Kirsten for a while. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's what most actors say, isn't it?
Oh, my God, yes. I love it. It's just, I could do this forever.
That's right. It's nice to be somebody else for a while, isn't it?
It is. I heard you're talking about, like, a job interview and stuff. What is that?
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, we'll have to come back to that another time, Kirsten. That was just a sort of a clip of a young person who didn't really understand office etiquette. But I'm sure you do, and you're doing very well. Call again, Kirsten. Great to hear from you. Okay, when we come back, we'll be changing gears and speaking to Lieutenant General Thomas Spohr about America's defense and also the fight for freedom of speech. Back after these words. Stay tuned to the Charlie Frequency. To have your company this Tuesday morning. Now, every day, the Heritage Foundation is building an America where freedom, opportunity, prosperity, and civil society flourish. Heritage's mission is to formulate and promote public policies based on the principles of free enterprise, limited government, individual freedom, and traditional American values. And that includes a strong national defense. So where is the USA today when it comes to these core values, especially when it comes to freedom of speech and the defense of the nation? In that last regard, who better to turn to than Thomas Spohr, who also just happens to have served 36 years in the U.S. Army, attaining the rank of Lieutenant General. And today he conducts and supervises research on national defense matters for the Heritage Foundation. Lieutenant General Spohr, welcome to the Turley Frequency.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Now, how am I to address you? Can I call you Thomas, or must I call you Lieutenant General?
No, you please call me Tom.
Tom, even better. Tom, thank you for that.
Yeah.
Now, listen,
yeah.
Tom, I was just reading one of your articles this morning, because the last segment we were talking about a sort of a crisis amongst millennials in sort of getting into the workplace, being able to understand basic stuff that you and I would have got immediately upon day one, how to dress, how to act, you know, that the workplace is not an extension of the kindergarten. You know, there's all sorts of rules and regulations. We've got to be adult in those situations. And I know recently you wrote co-wrote an article about military recruitment and the fact that military recruitment is dropping like the proverbial stone. Talk to me a bit about that. What do you think is behind that? Why are young Americans today not enlisting in the Army as they did in days gone by?
Yeah, great question. And so, you know, first off, it's not a simple answer. It's a complex answer. And there's many factors playing into this. Military recruiting has never been really easy. The military made their goals, made their quotas, but they didn't make them by too much. And so it's always been kind of a close call. What we have now is an economy that is very robust. You know, we have Burger King hiring cashiers at $13, $14, $15 an hour, same with Amazon, mm-hmm. same with other employees. And so the competition for talent is very tight. And these some of these companies are even offering programs to help young people with college tuition. And so, you know, it used to be just the military offered help with college tuition. Now other companies are in that game as well. And so the competition for young people, young people's talent is very tight. You combine that with fewer and fewer Americans, young people, qualify for military service. Only 23% of Americans qualify without a waiver to join the military. And that's being driven by rising rates of obesity, poor health, bad test scores, bad scores that aren't, you know, high enough to get them in the military. And then the final ingredient to this is fewer and fewer young people actually want to join the military. And that's a complex problem of not knowing very much about the military, and what they know about it is probably wrong. There's a concern, at least for some audiences, about is the military going woke, too woke, and they don't want to be part of an organization like that. And so all these various factors combine to make military recruiting right now the worst it has ever been since the beginning of the all-volunteer force in 1973.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, what you say, Tom, doesn't really surprise me in a sense, because, I mean, when I was growing up, and if you mentioned the U.S. military to me, images of John Wayne or Audie Murphy, these sort of characters would flutter through my mind, and it would be a real kind of adventure, a patriotic adventure. But since 1973, that seems to have, certainly in the public consciousness, there's been a sort of anti-military in the media, in Hollywood. You know, it's almost like it's seen as something necessary, but not really something to aspire to, and certainly not an honorable calling. Or is that just my impression?
You know, it kind of goes and falls. And so 9/11, when we had the attacks on the World Trade Center, you know, patriotism came up. People saw this need to serve their country. But that was brief and short-lived, and the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq kind of persuaded a lot of people that we were kind of on the wrong track. They didn't see their military winning in those wars. The disastrous withdrawal from Afghanistan further added to that image that their military wasn't competent. And then on top of all that, you have popular culture, you know, movies that show the military is bumbling fools or people getting wounded and things like that. And none of that adds up in the eyes of young people as something that they want to be a part of. And so we have this image in popular society of a military that is not competent, and that if you join it, you might come away with psychological scars or, you know, physical wounds. And that's just not, you know, in this marketplace for labor, that people don't see much advantage in doing that.
Right. And of course, I mean, these films are often made by people who have never served a day in the military, whereas I'm talking to somebody who has, done 30-odd years in the military, but you've also been deployed in war zones. You were in Grenada and you were in Iraq. You've seen it close up and personal, if you like. And I know you've got a son who's serving in the military, so that speaks volumes in itself, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, I'd like to think so. A lot of people in the military that serve, their children see the lifestyle and they want to be a part of that, either for, you know, maybe one term or maybe for even longer. And I think, you know, and the other thing is that people that are in the military, they call it the retention rate, you know, of people that sign up for another hitch. That is very high right now. So people that get in the military actually like it. That's not the problem. It's the problem of convincing young people right off the bat to join at all. And that's just a matter of bad image and bad communication. So is a great part of that. If people don't understand, you know, what the military can do for them, you know, you read all the time in the news about student debt, you know, and how these young people are facing crushing amounts of debt of like $100,000 that they paid to go to college or something like that. And the military, you know, gives that opportunity to, you know, they'll pay for your college education, whether you're leave the service or whether you're still in the service and get your degree while you're in it. And people just aren't aware of these opportunities, I think.
That's right. No, absolutely. Yeah. You know, the other thing which they're probably not aware of is it's not just that there's life after the military, but presumably as well, you can vouch for the fact that whilst you're enlisted as a man or a woman, you're going to be learning so many skills. Life skills, of course, and skills of leadership and all the rest of it, but also some very practical skills which are translatable into the civilian workforce.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, a lot of people, young people, if they're not in the military, don't get the opportunity to lead others and to kind of come up with a plan. And so, you know, whether you're leading four or five people or maybe 30 or 40, you know, these are skills that you don't get typically in the civilian workplace. And then when people leave the military at some point, they come out, you know, businesses and corporations find these people very useful because they know how to relate to other people. They have interpersonal skills. They know how to get things done. They show up for work on time. And so all these things make people so useful and valuable to private industry, but people can't see that when they're sitting in high school. They don't have that perspective, I think.
Absolutely. You probably know, Tom, that our executive producer, Michelle McAloon, has two sons who are serving in the military at the moment, and she tells me they love it. They absolutely love it. So they are, and I know she's served her country as well. So these are the real people involved in this. But you said something there about civilian organizations being very attracted to people coming out of the military. They've got very good skill sets, good mindsets as well, and also leadership capacity. Now, all of that must have been in the sights of the Heritage Foundation when you came along, Tom. So talk to me a little bit about your transition from the military to the Heritage Fund. Do you still feel like you're fighting for your country?
I do. I mean, that's what I love about being at Heritage. You know, when I was getting ready to leave the military, I'd been in for 36 years. It was, you know, I joined the military right out of college, and I had known nothing differently from that. And so I was looking for an opportunity to keep serving, keep doing something for this country, stay involved with the military. And, you know, I looked at opportunities with big companies that sell weapons to the government, and that's not a bad thing to do, but I wanted something that could help me stay engaged and provide service to this country. And Heritage does that. It allows us to explain national defense to American citizens and what our country needs in a way that, you know, I don't know where else I could get this kind of an opportunity to write and to speak in terms of the soldiers and the service members that are serving in our military. Still there?
Yes, sorry, Tom. I am. I was just thinking as you were speaking there. I mean, your remit within the Heritage Foundation is very much around defense, but the Heritage Foundation is really, I mean, the kind of parameters of which it deals with all aspects of the U.S. society. I mean, it really does feel like a fight for the spirit of America. I mean, one of the things I said at the introduction was that it's the true values of America, what it really means to be American. And that seems to be the fight that Heritage is engaged in at the moment. Or am I reading it wrong?
No, you're exactly right. I mean, I love defense, and that's what I'm most passionate about, but I love other things that Heritage does, too. They're fighting for school choice. They're fighting to keep, you know, our children away from these pernicious forces that want to, you know, cause them to question their gender and all these kinds of things, you know, things that, you know, you sit at home and you read about it and you shake your head and you say, how can we let this happen? And Heritage actually gives me, and probably you as well, the opportunity to actually talk and actually fight back against these ideas, which I think are corrupting America.
Well, that's right, because, I mean, ideas are not new. It's not a neutral zone, the public space. There's always somebody trying to take advantage of it or to foist ideas upon us. So it's very important that there are organizations like Heritage saying, no, we have a different view, and it's well thought out, it's professional, it's well done, which, as a military man, must have attracted you in some senses, because there must have been an endless number of opportunities for retired Lieutenant General Thomas Spohr when you left the services. But the reason that you went to the Heritage, I guess, must have been because you saw something that was as well-formed and as well-drilled as any military unit.
Yeah, I mean, Heritage is a very disciplined organization. The meetings start on time. The coffee is hot. People are passionate about their mission here. And so they, you know, they come to work. They work hard all day. And that's very much like the military, which appealed to me. You know, there weren't endless opportunities for me, but there were some other ones, and they even had probably better pay. But this is an organization that gives you a sense of purpose, and you feel like every day you've done something for your country. And that's what appeals to me.
Okay, listen, I'm in conversation with retired Lieutenant General Thomas Spohr, who is currently working for the Heritage Foundation. If you have any questions about the nation's defence or about the work of Heritage, then we would be delighted to take them. You can call us on 888-928-0881, or if you prefer, I'll ask your questions. You can text me on 251-928-2111. We'll be back straight after these words. Stay tuned to the Turley Frequency. Here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. I'm in conversation with retired Lieutenant General Thomas Spohr, who is currently working with the Heritage Foundation and has very kindly allowed me to call him Tom, even though I'm about a private in this army, Tom. I've got a question for you here from our audience. Very, very good question, sure. I think. What makes a good leader?
First, it starts with character. And so if you're not a man or woman of character, you're going to fail because people will see through that. And so it starts from the inside first versus your external actions. And then by living out what you say and do, you know, by your actions, you know, people slowly begin to respect you, and then you command their respect, and then you can actually ask them to do things, which may in the military, at least, put their lives and put them in risk. That's the only way you're really going to be able to get them to actually do what needs to be done.
Absolutely. That's a good answer. Now, I heard somebody commenting at the weekend about the state of the U.S. political scene, and they said basically that a uniformed army would never be sent into the United States to take it over. But instead, what you do is you mute freedom of speech, you weaken all the borders, and you basically sort of demoralize the civilian population. And I heard this critique, and I thought there may be something in that. What do you think?
No, I think that's true. I mean, no one's ever going to take the United States by force. They could, you know, launch nuclear weapons on us or something like that. But the biggest dangers are that we allow our own society to be corrupted by, you know, forces that are kind of opposed to the principles that you find in the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. That's the biggest danger, that we forget about, you know, how great this republic is and what the benefits it brings to our citizens and society. And we turn our backs on our history and go in some direction which, you know, compromises our rights as citizens.
Absolutely. I can't, I mean, this weekend as well, there was a lot of news about the Ukraine and Russia and the whole sort of attempted coup there. As an ex-military man, have you any views on that at the moment? How do you see that sort of playing out? Are we any near the end of this conflict?
You know, I think, you know, and other people have said this, is that this mutiny, this coup, if you will, by Prigozhin kind of revealed some cracks in Putin's armor. Everybody to this point, at least, thought that Putin was invulnerable, that he was some kind of Superman. You know, they remember him riding horseback without a shirt on, and they remember him as a karate instructor. And this kind of showed him very vulnerable, you know, in his capital with an army advancing on his column. And he was forced to negotiate with this former convict, former caterer, you know, and from a position of weakness, you know, and having to make concessions. And so, you know, this isn't the end of Putin's regime. You know, dictators are very hard to run out of town, but this at least shows people in Russia that he is vulnerable, and that there is a potential for somebody other than Putin to be running that country. And that's very valuable. It's not the end. It's not even the beginning of the end, but I think this has at least shown citizens of Russia that their leader has some flaws.
Mm. And I mean, from a military perspective, I mean, does that sort of civilian leadership in one form or another, either its weakness or its strength, does that sort of filter down into the army, the military?
Absolutely. You know, absolutely. You know, as a former soldier, soldiers love to gossip. And so everybody in the Russian army knows about this coup by now. They know what happened. And that there was a revolt. And so, you know, as they're sitting on the front lines in, of Ukraine facing these Ukrainian attacks, you know, they're wondering, what is going on with my country? You know, what is this rebellion about? Is, are things as sure and as certain as they were when I signed up to be in the military? So this introduces an element of doubt, which is crucial in war. I mean, you need your armies to be convinced of the righteousness of their cause. And I think there's a lot of reason to believe that they don't have that today.
Yes, absolutely. And that's probably the beginning of some sort of an ending. What it is yet, we don't quite know. I have another question from a listener saying, why is it important to keep supporting Ukraine's struggle?
Yeah, and so I think we're seeing that already. You know, it's this tension that is causing Russia to struggle. And if Russia isn't stopped in Ukraine, they could go to other places like Moldova in Europe, and then eventually, if they continue to get stronger, let's say they absorb Ukraine, they would, may have the strength now to threaten somebody that's actually in NATO, like Poland or Romania, also on their borders. And so we can either stop Russia here in Ukraine, or we can allow it to go stronger and bigger and wait for it to threaten NATO, which would bring in now U.S. service members and U.S. force, and we'd have U.S. soldiers being killed versus us just providing support in the form of arms and money to Ukraine. So I think this is the better alternative to that. But, you know, the message of anything else is that dictators like Putin, the only thing they understand is force. You know, they don't understand diplomacy or treaties or any other documents like that. They just understand sheer force. And so that is Europe and the United States taking a stand saying, no, Mr. Putin, you cannot have this country of Ukraine.
Mm. Now, we're in the middle of that war over here in Europe. You yourself have been deployed in various combat zones. Tom, how did that experience, first of all, what was the chief surprise of being in that situation? But also, how did it change you as a person?
I think it just places you in the point of the soldier, the service member, and thinking about how difficult it is, what it is like to be separated, you know, for months on end from your family, the physical danger, the hardships. And so you're less willing to, you know, think about or recommend or propose or support recommending the commitment of U.S. forces, except in the most, you know, situations where our national interests are at risk. And so you hear some armchair quarterbacks are like, well, shoot, we should just send the military to go do this or do that. And then when you actually see it up close, you realize how hard it is, how expensive it is, and how difficult it is on our service members to go do these things.
Yeah.
They sign up to do these things, but they want to make sure that when they are put in these kind of situations, it's actually for a vital interest.
No, absolutely. And it's always somebody else's son or daughter they're sending off to the front line as well, which is always, as you say, the armchair quarterbacks. I have another question here, which is sort of it's an interesting one because it's asking how military expenditure, and I guess that's from the U.S. government, how that's tied to U.S. freedom. And I guess that's the idea that you're protecting the freedom at home as much as you're trying to win freedom for certain people abroad. Is that something that the average soldier, the average officer actually thinks about?
I think they're thinking about it a lot. One is, you know, you go to some countries where the people are not free, and you think about what they're losing, you know, what they don't have. And then you come back to the United States when the end of your tour is over, and it just strikes you in the face that you have the ability to go march, you know, in front of the U.S. Capitol or down, you know, in front of the White House with a sign, and you can't do that in many countries. But I think, you know, people understand the United States, even though, you know, people overseas will criticize us, they understand that fundamentally we stand for freedom. We want people to have the ability to first free speech and free religion and to demonstrate their views, and that's understood. You know, even though people will be critical of the United States, they understand that. And generally speaking, U.S. forces operate in that manner. They work with other countries' militaries to make them stronger if they are, in fact, heading towards democracy or our democracy. And they won't do that so much for anybody that's not.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned it just previously, this idea that certainly what gets the headlines is sometimes what's the sort of woke ideas that have penetrated the military, and they get a lot of play in the media. I'm not sure. How real do you think they are? Or do you think this is kind of window dressing that doesn't really affect the average life of the average serviceman or woman?
No, I think it has an insidious effect. I kind of creeps in. So some of these woke policies will permit people that aren't qualified to either join the military or to enter into certain military specialties for which they're not qualified, because we're trying to be, you know, promote this idea of equity and that everybody should have the ability to do anything they want. And, you know, it'll sound cruel, but the military is discriminatory. They are discriminate. You know, there are certain things, like I don't think I could pass the Special Forces qualification test. I couldn't pass Ranger school. I'm not in that kind of physical shape anymore. And that's the military you want. You want in a military that's exclusive, and you want high standards that not everybody can match. And slowly, wokeness kind of erodes that. And they say, well, shoot, anybody that wants to do this, we should figure out a way for them to do it. And that's the road to ruin for a military, if anybody can do anything. And so there's that. There's this, you know, that they spend and divert a lot of time and resources into programs which don't lead to increased war fighting, like, you know, solar panels or diversity and equity training, you know, where service members should be out practicing their war fighting skills. You know, they're sitting in classrooms learning about these programs, which diverts away from the readiness of our military. So, you know, people who say, hey, I don't see much of it at my level, but, you know, if you sit back and say, well, what about this? What about that? They're like, well, yeah, you're right. I am feeling that. So it kind of creeps in without you even knowing, I think.
And it creeps in because of politicians and because of legislators and people saying that this is important and we need to do it. And I guess your work in the Heritage Foundation, Tom, is trying to get the right thinking, the right ideas that start to permeate not just the military, but the wider society. Today, one of the things the Heritage Foundation is very keen on is obviously freedom of speech, and it's probably never been more under attack, certainly in my lifetime. What do you see as the most insidious threat to U.S. society today?
Yeah, I mean, that is the idea that, you know, you can be canceled and just for your views on things, you know, and called a racist or called even probably worse things just because, you know, you stand up for certain values and things like that, which, you know, country was founded upon, and now have become out of style and out of fashion. And so I worry about the readiness of the military, but I worry more about this idea that society is trying to cancel voices and make things unpopular that, you know, we've always kind of treasured in this world, in this country.
That's right, because I'm sure we probably both agree, Tom, that's just another form of fascism when you start canceling people.
Exactly. I couldn't agree more.
Absolutely. So you're just breaking up a little bit, Tom, at the moment. So we'll persevere. We'll keep going in the true military spirit. But so one final question. When you look back over all your time in the military, and you did 36 years, as you say, if you were a young man today in President Biden's United States, would you be enlisting and giving your life to the Constitution of the United States once again?
I would. I would do it in a heartbeat. I mean, The memories I have of the military, you know, especially those where I was able to help somebody get ahead, the things I learned, the ability I had to make a difference, especially in other people's lives, I wouldn't trade that for anything. So the military, like maybe any other human endeavor, is not perfect. It has its flaws. Every once in a while, people will not be promoted that ought to be promoted. But given all that, it is a great choice for a young person that wants to serve their country, to better themselves, and to make a difference for others.
Absolutely. Well, it's been a great pleasure and an honor to meet you, if only via the wonders of modern communication. tell people where they can find out more about your current work with the Heritage Foundation.
Yeah, so if you go to heritage.org, you'll find all of our stuff there that we published, both our opinion pieces and our research reports, and we would be delighted to, you know, if one of your listeners wants to engage us on a particular topic, we're all about talking. And so, you know, ask, you know, go to that site, look around and see what you think.
Sounds good. Well, on behalf of all our listeners, retired Lieutenant General Thomas Spoor, can I thank you for all your service to the United States and also for your continued service to help the cause of freedom right across the United States today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me on your show.
Thank you very much. Okay, when we come back, we will be speaking to somebody who's a five-star general, and that is the Lord. We're going to be praying the Divine Mercy Chaplet. If you've got an intention, you can get us get now on texting us 251-928-2111, or why don't you think about calling the show on 888-928-0881. We'd be delighted to hear from you. So we'll be back after these words of the Divine Mercy Chaplet. Stay tuned to the Charlie Frequency here on Archangel Radio.